Well, actually, that same exact question came up yesterday in my other class. Don asked Ra in session maybe 66, something like, "How important is the spine upright or vertical in meditation?" Ra said, "It's somewhat important." Meaning, it's some, or I think it was somewhat helpful. How helpful? Don asked. Ra answered, "Somewhat helpful." Meaning, yes, it's helpful, but it's not essential. And I would agree. There are many considerations. The main, there's meditation at early stages and middle and late, and there are the multiple goals of meditation. In many ways, the teaching, meditate sitting up versus don't meditate lying down. Is because it's more likely to go to sleep if you're lying down. That's the main motivation, I believe, for that teaching. Meaning, don't lie down meditating because you'll probably go to sleep. Now, from a perspective that says it's okay to go to sleep, which is mine, meaning, if I go to sleep, meditation, which happens, I don't think that's a problem. The question is, are you going to keep meditating after you wake up? Or are you going to keep meditating the next day or later? If you do, I think it's fine. If you don't, ultimately it's fine too, but you won't be getting much benefit from meditation if you just meditate and go to sleep and don't meditate again. So I think it's fine to meditate with your back against the wall if it helps for sitting longer. Now, eventually, if the meditation is strong, one doesn't go to sleep, and one forgets about the body. If to the extent that one feels itching or needs to scratch for the whole hour, let's say you're sitting for an hour, one can't forget about the body. To the extent that one's uncomfortable in a full lotus, ideal position, also one cannot forget about the body. So, a half lotus, or sitting with the back against the wall, or even lying down, if it can lead one, if in that position, in those positions, one can get into concentration and therefore be forgetting about the body, that's better than, super yogi full lotus. For 2 hours, feeling irritation at the body the whole time. Or being unable to forget about the body, meaning being unable to focus on the concentration on the object, like the breath. So, from an energetic standpoint, yeah, spine erect, not touching anything, is better than touching the wall. Leaning on the wall or lying down. However, there are many dynamics in play too. If you look at Nityananda, in his earlier years, you saw him, it was a perfectly erect spine, very strong body, sitting for hours and hours and hours. Yogi young man. In older years, you see him lying down all the time. Very masterfully, actually, meaning he didn't look like he was sleepy. He looked like he was doing, subtle, non-physical work all the time, actually, meaning out of body and at multiple locations, lying down. So there's a certain circulation of energy that is associated with not touching anything. Other than sitting on the floor cross-legged, that energy circulation is the energy circulation associated with sitting cross-legged, particularly double lotus, full lotus, but not necessarily, but sitting cross-legged on a cushion or without a cushion, not touching anything, not leaning against the wall. That energy circulation, in certain ways, is ideal. But that ideal, the value or the need for such an ideal energy circulation is more associated with later stages of the path than earlier. Earlier stages of the working in meditation focuses on the value of concentration. And if leaning against the wall allows one to more easily go into concentration by having less discomfort sensation in the body, then it's probably better. And I don't think there's anything wrong with any posture, actually, and one can go into samadhi in any posture, ideally or potentially. So I think it's fine. And if you can move into concentration or sit longer and go to concentration or samadhi with the back against the wall, then it's probably better than sitting with irritation in mind or pain sensation in body sitting in the middle of the room. So it's the same kind of thing about scratch or don't scratch. There can be toxic release in meditation, meaning incessant, intense itchiness on a certain portion of the body. Like some kind of thing is coming out in that part of the body only, some kind of toxin or whatever. Should I scratch or not scratch? Well, do what you want. If you scratch, scratch, scratch like a monkey, you're obviously not going to go into be able to do much concentration on the breath or samadhi, but that might be the fastest way to lead it to no longer keep arising by scratch, 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 rather than sit the whole hour feeling irritated and by not, by it, by the sensation and not scratching it. So, swallow or don't swallow in terms of saliva gathering in the mouth. Or itchy on the body. I've done both, and I think there's a value to disciplining oneself to not take care of the sensation, and there's value to taking care of it, meaning following the natural reaction, because it will end. But anyway, these are certain kind of considerations in meditation. I mean, as the samadhi deepens, there's less sensation arising in the body, or there's less perception of sensation in the body, and there's less desire to do anything about that sensation in the body. Is it less itchy in samadhi, or there's less perception of itchy? I don't know. Both. I mean, in earlier stages of meditation, like if you're sitting for an hour in the first 20 minutes, it's very normal, at least for me, for most people, I would imagine, that there'll be some strong discomfort, uncomfortable sensation in body, and the mind wants to take care of it by direct action. Itch, scratch the itch, or adjust the knee or something, or move the position. As samadhi goes on, there's less sensation perceived. There's less sensation or there's less perception of sensation. Therefore, there's less desire to do anything to adjust the body or itch or scratch an itch. One can go, so it's a matter of how you want to get there. That's the typical kind of teaching that you're saying there on how to handle uncomfortable sensation in body. Take care of it mindfully, move your position mindfully, scratch the itch mindfully. That's fine. One shouldn't make a big deal out of that either. Meaning, oh, I'm raising my arm, raising, raising, moving, moving, dropping, dropping, scratching, scratching, raising, raising, moving, moving, dropping, dropping, back to my old position. Okay, now we'll go to my breath. This is, to me, you see some people walking in Vipassana retreats, they look like zombies. They look like they're like lifting, right? For the walking meditation, they're thinking in their mind something. They walk really slowly. Now, there are traditions where that's great. Or there are guys who are way beyond my level who've done it that way. And then there are Westerners who do that very well, I imagine, for themselves. But, you know, it the speed is not critical when there's mindfulness, and the even the intentionality of mindfulness is not important when there's a greater stability in mind. And that's the teaching that I talked about before, called Amanasikara. And this is super esoteric, and you can't find, there's very, very little to find online about it. I'll see what I can find for you here. This is saying it's sometimes translated as, you know, non-attentiveness. So I write Amanasikara, and Google says, did you mean Manasikara? No, I didn't. And the first document basically is the guy who promoted this teaching, Maitri Gupta, was a Siddha Mahayana, very tantric kind of Buddhist, about, you know, 1,000 years ago. And this first document, I'll just send the link if people like that, PDF by Mark Tatz. Mark Tatz taught at CIIS, where I was, when I was there in the late 80s, and I took some of his classes. And he taught about Amanasikara and the Siddhas. And so one translation for Amanasikara is non-conceptual realization, or non-attentiveness. And the Hindus have some view of this too. It's an advanced perspective on mindfulness, recognizing that we shouldn't get attached to mindfulness. So yeah, there it is. It's titled Maitri Gupta Siddha. This is deep in the mind of Mahayana Tantric Buddhism 1,000 years ago. 1,007-1,085. 11th century. His name was Maitri Gupta, Advaya Vajra. His teaching was Amanasikara. And, you know, this is super, super scholarly kind of writing. Talking about Tibetan commentator analyzed it this way, and the other guy analyzed it that way, and in this catalog it looks like that, and the other documentation of it looks like that. It's the idea of freedom from all extremes in view. But it's ultimately freedom from any kind of assertion or negation. In meditation, it means don't get hung up on mindfulness. Don't posit or make assertion or a story or in meditation about, I must do it this way, now I'm doing it the right way. In many ways, I mean, I don't know anything, and I'm just at whatever level I'm at. But my key, what was critical for me along the path of meditation to this point, is just returning to the object of concentration, scratching or not scratching, swallowing or not, adjusting, moving the body or not, this position or that, it doesn't matter. Again and again and again and again, back to a pretty narrow focus on what? A sensation at the nose, or the experience of breath passage, or no breath, meaning after, when breath slows down, there's no sensation. There's nothing to focus on other than focusing on nothing, or focusing on this beingness here. But that kind of singular focus upon a narrowed object of concentration, that spirit, that attitude, ultimately, gets into samadhi and jhana, and doesn't make such a big deal out of how it's done, or all the other things happening along the way. And there's a very nice discussion from Thanissaro Bhikkhu about jhana. I just sent the link, which is goes through the four jhanas. But the last point there that is very interesting, the four jhanas, the eight jhanas are form-based and then formless. They are states or levels of concentration or samadhi. And the fourth is critical, so you could read more about the fourth jhana. But the phrase that I want to focus on is on the bottom of the page, jhana and insight hand in hand. And Thanissaro is a great translator. And the stanza is, there's no jhana for one with no discernment. No discernment for one with no jhana. But one with both jhana and discernment, he's on the verge of unbinding. So there's no concentration, samadhi, deeper meditation if the person has no discernment. And there's no discernment for the person who doesn't know how to get into concentration, samadhi, one-pointedness. But for the person who is able to move mind to concentration, one-pointedness, calm abiding, stillness, samadhi, clarity, non-grasping, peace, equanimity, that for the one who can do that and has discernment, that one is on the edge of Nibbana. That one is approaching freedom from all rebirth. Now, the link is between equanimity, concentration, stability, samadhi. Samadhi, jhana. Jhana basically is the result of samadhi, or samadhi and jhana are, samadhi is associated with the state of consciousness or mind. Jhana is sort of a term for the various states of samadhi. And the fourth jhana is critical again, as the position, as the state of mind or level from which one can, from which a gnosis may dawn. It's not one can get it, but from which a gnosis realization, awareness release may occur. How? Simply by deep enough samadhi, as far as I know. But what was critical to me here is that discernment comes naturally as samadhi or jhana becomes stable. Jhana, or these different states of concentration, stability, quiet, focus, silence of mind at a steady state. What Ra said, silence of mind at a steady state. In Ra's view, they said, from which to listen to the deep mind or connect with the deep mind or listen to self, to listen to the self or communicate with self. Gautama is not talking about self, the experience of a mind need not imply existence of a self or a defined separative identity, obviously. But it was nice for me to see that these states of concentration, calm abiding, stability, silence of mind, clarity, called jhana or samadhi, as those deepen, so too will discernment. That's beautiful comment for me because I'm seeking discernment too, and I believe I can experience a bit of discernment too, or more now than before, so it seems to me. And that's simply the result of jhana or concentration or samadhi or meditation. So however you can get there is okay, meaning scratch or no scratch, move the body or not, adjust from this position or that, back against the wall or lying down or sitting up in the middle of the room, 5 minutes or 55 minutes is fine. So long as one can, you know, learn to be free from grasping and following, making a big story in the mind. Then you will find discernment. And so you can't see clearly, you can't see objects clearly when you're riding in a moving car. You can't see reflections on the water when the water is in agitation or motion. And that's exactly the link between discernment and jhana. And the people who, you know, those who don't have discernment, or us with our limitations of discernment, are basically limitations of stillness, equanimity, one-pointedness, the ability to have concentration, silence of mind at a steady state. And as silence of mind at a steady state, or samadhi, clarity, stillness, concentration, one-pointedness, as that grows, so too will discernment. And when both of those are strong, one is nearby. One is nearby Nibbana. Thanks again. Take good care, and good night.